Hi, I'm Dominic Patton.
And I'm Pete Hammond.
And this is the Deadline Podcast TV Talk.
Today we're going to be discussing the new streaming services that launched during the pandemic. Peacock, HBO Max, Quibi. Then you're going to hear a snippet of Dominic's conversation with Mindy Kaling and Lang Fisher, the creators of the Netflix show Never Have I Ever.
Yes. And never have I ever seen so many streamers with absolutely nothing to say. One day after HBO Max launches, and it didn't really have a lot of firepower in the arsenal. Now, some of that, let's just be straight up. Some of that has to do with the fact that there's a global pandemic happening, coronavirus, and things like the much-hyped Friends reunion special saw its production plug pulled, like almost everything in the industry saw back in March. But still, HBO Max launched yesterday with, well, really a lot of reality shows and an Anna Kendrick series called Love Life, which is kind of really should be called, as I said in my review, Sucks to Be Me in the City, and the actually quite charming Not Too Late show with Elmo, which is good for both the little ones and, I have to admit, the big ones too. Otherwise, not a lot.
Well, you know, HBO Max is certainly launching with a big publicity campaign. I have been besieged, Dominic, by promotional items and all kinds of things from HBO Max. So I think they're putting a lot of, and I mentioned this in a story that I wrote on Friday about how the whole business of awards campaigning and things may change with the Oscars, and that maybe HBO Max is helping to lead the way. They had a virtual world premiere that I decided to attend for that Anna Kendrick series, Love Life. And it was crazy, man. It had an after party with four different rooms you could go into virtually. They sent a karaoke microphone so I could sing along with the soundtrack in these places. They had a DJ spinning records. They had a woman.
Yeah, but that's exactly it. You know, with Peacock and with Quibi and with HBO Max, these guys are all the karaoke version of Netflix and Amazon and Hulu. And the fact of the matter is, in this much baited streaming wars era that we're in, the only new player on the block to show up with anything resembling a jab was Disney Plus. Specifically with The Mandalorian, the Star Wars live action series. HBO Max, Peacock, and Quibi, they don't have a Mandalorian. And therefore, they don't really seem to have, in my opinion, a lot of reason to be here right now. And that's the thing you have to ask people. Because really, you're asking people in the middle of a global pandemic that also happens to be an economic crisis that we have never seen the likes of in our lifetimes or maybe ever in the Western economy, you're saying to people, hey, give us some more money. You know, hey, give us another $15. Give us another this. That's exactly why Jeffrey Katzenberg and Meg Whitman Quibi has just fallen off the top 50 and probably even the top 75 most downloaded apps. Because the people don't have a reason for it and they don't want to pay for it. Even in that case, they gave them 90 days for free and they still couldn't get many people to sign up in the first round. And they admitted it themselves.
Okay, Dominic, let me ask. Do you have something against Anna Kendrick? She's got a show.
No, not at all. No.
And both those things are, I like her a lot here. And you're knocking the people that are bringing Anna Kendrick into our living room and, in fact, in Quibi, onto our phones. And
I said in my review of Love Life, if it wasn't for the presence of Anna Kendrick, who is, pun intended, almost always pitch perfect, Love Life would be a total tragedy. As it is, it's just a very bad ripoff of Sex and the City.
Okay. Now, here's the thing you haven't mentioned. You have sort of skirted around it. But two of these services, Peacock and HBO Max, have decided to go into this business by taking off the most popular show on Netflix in both cases, The Office and also Friends, and taking it back. Yeah. Because they own it and they are banking on this thing to get eyeballs on their services by bringing in the golden oldies, as it were. Is that a bad strategy?
Well, I actually think it is. I'll tell you why. Because the thing about The Office and Friends being on Netflix is there are two main elements. One, if you're watching The Office or Friends, I kind of guarantee you've watched them before. So this is comfort TV. Personally, for me, The West Wing fulfills that function in many ways. So there's that. So I don't think people are actually going to clamor if they have their cheese whiz taken away from them. And secondly, I don't know if a golden oldie is enough to get you to sign up with the new kid in town. Again, if you have a Netflix subscription, you're already getting this. If you're going to lose it, well, it turns out the Ted Sarandos run streaming service kind of has a lot of other stuff you can watch too. So they seem to be doing quite well. I mean, actually, look, let's be honest. In an economic crisis we're in, their stock is going up. I just feel like if I was, I am not, I have never been asked to be, but if I was an executive at Quibi, at HBO Max, or at Peacock, or their own companies, Comcast and AT&T, and Jeffrey Katzenberg's parent company, I would have said, you know what? No one's going to fault us for hitting the pause button on this. This is a crisis that we have never foreseen, never anticipated, and no one knows a playbook on. Let's just hold off. Yeah, I've been inundated too with HBO Max specifically, hype. A lot of it's pretty great. I've like Game of Thrones chessboard, which was amazing.
Yes,
but
yes.
I have also seen in major urban centers where there is a stay at home or safer at home, as they say in LA, mandatory order, flooding the zone with billboards where you compare The Sopranos and other shows that you're going to have on your service to each other. Not a lot of eyeballs, pal. Not a lot of eyeballs out there. So I don't really know what they're hoping to achieve or how they can do the metrics of success. And if nothing else.
Somebody asked me this yesterday, as a matter of fact. They said, okay, what is HBO Max? Okay, so there's HBO. There's HBO Now. There's HBO Go.
Oh, yeah.
Is that taking away? All the money we're now spending, and our producer here, David Janov, gave me the numbers here, $10. I don't want to buy it with ads, so I got to have it without ads. So $10, $15, $25, and $8, $33. What, you know, I mean, just for these three. And what are we getting here, man? Is HBO Go going bye-bye, or HBO Now no more?
Well, here's the thing. They're not. Like, these streaming services are going to continue, or these replay services, let's call them. What I think HBO Max's is strategy for growth was, we're going to have all this stuff you can't get somewhere else. And this is my criticism of these streamers. I say the more the merrier on the digital battlefield. I say bring in that AT&T money, bring in that Comcast money. And let's also be honest, poor Peacock. Their launch strategy was built around the Olympics, which got pushed to next year because of COVID-19. So again, I'm just saying, if you know, one of the great things about the media, the entertainment industry, is how nimble it can be. James Bond, the new James Bond movie, was literally, it felt like hours away from debuting, and they went, nope, you know what? We're just pushing it back. We're pushing it back because we're not going to see theaters being open, we're not going to see people in theaters, and we don't want to have a bomb out of this great Bond movie with Daniel Craig's last hurrah. So we're making a move. And you see people do that very quickly. But HBO Max and Peacock and Quibi, and you know, they're like old tanks that just can't seem to turn around, or like ships heading towards the iceberg that it's too hard to get out of the way than it is to crash. And I just feel like that to me shows tactics, not strategy, as their plan. Well, and if you don't have a Friends reunion, if you don't have the Olympics as your launch board, you know what? No one is going to call you a loser for just saying, hey, just going to step back a bit, going to wait till this happens, going to get all of our best stuff ready, going to get it all produced, and then we're going to come out. And if they don't believe any of that, they should just look at what happened to Disney Plus. Disney Plus had an amazing launch, amazing. And they had great numbers, millions of signups, and they themselves recognized, now the Mandalorian's over. What do we have to offer people? Because we don't have any of these Marvel shows ready yet or stuff like that. They actually tried to fill the gap with a Mandalorian documentary series, which unto itself, because people are so hungry for Star Wars, was a great success for them as well. If you don't have a hit show to launch your new streaming rocket, just say, you know what? We're postponing for technical reasons, and we'll be back after the pandemic.
Okay, so what Disney Plus has done is they did realize that they need to keep feeding this monster that they've created now and others. So what do? They spent $75 million for a pre-recorded Hamilton thing that was done with the original cast at the time. And they spent it to release it theatrically and decided, you know what? We need this to keep our service going. We have to keep feeding the monster and get those subscribers, which is a lesson that Netflix should have taught everybody. It's always been about subscribers and everything else be damned with Netflix. And so they've got Hamilton coming on July 3rd, and they've got Artemis Fowl coming in a couple of weeks, which was meant to be a big theatrical release too. They're sort of stuck in this mode here of having to deliver new product. And as you say, the Mandalorian isn't going to do it on its own.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I mean, honestly, I ask you, how would you have felt if you'd gotten an email about, I don't know, 5 weeks ago from HBO Max or from John Stankler, one of those guys there, and said, look, you know, clearly we're all going through something unprecedented right now, and we've just decided to hold off a few months on the launch of HBO Max. So people, you know, the real priority of health and safety can be tended to. And obviously, you know, acknowledging that a number of their shows had to shut production. Would you have thought, oh, losers, terrible. You guys are never going to get anywhere. Would you have thought that?
No, but I do think that they were sort of locked in one way or another. From what I said before, friends in The Office were driving these debuts. They took them off of Netflix, and they don't want to sit on this for another year. And also, people are still stuck watching television. It's the biggest, you know this, the numbers are way up in terms of this. And so they're thinking at least they have an audience that may give them a sampling. I want to add Apple. We haven't mentioned Apple. And I just have noticed an interesting thing, this being Emmy season here with that streamer, is they are very invested in the Emmy campaign season. And just like Netflix was and Amazon was, they're pouring money into it. There feels
it's funny. It's like Apple. Apple has kind of, Apple in a way was the template minus the pandemic for a lot of these other streamers. They came out with a few new shows, but it really wasn't enough to create fire. They had the morning show, which was open to a lot of criticism. But they seem to stumble out of the gate, but man, do they have their horses in line for the Emmys. They seem so mission driven now. It's like they found out, oh, what we do well is product launch. And we're going to treat the Emmys like a product launch. And suddenly, Apple are clicking into gear. Totally. Remarkable, actually.
That's what I see. In fact, I got a call from someone at Apple last week when Deadline ran the daytime Emmy nomination story. I'm not a big proponent of daytime Emmys. I think they give them to your hairdresser and everybody else in town. You know, they're just everywhere. But they're finally going back on network, which surprised me a little. But they were so excited. They said, we got, you know, more Emmy nominations than HBO and daytime for a show called Ghost Rider and stuff like that. And then pointed out that they have 53 nominations overall so far among awards that have come out since they've been on, and 19 wins. And so they're really starting to tout this. They've really drunk the Netflix Kool-Aid, you know, and before that, the Harvey Weinstein method of making your name by getting the...
Well, hold on. We're talking about the Harvey Weinstein award season and nominations method, correct?
Yes. Yes.
Exactly. Yes. We'll be very specific. That is what we're talking about.
No, don't you worry about that. Don't you worry about that at all. Dominic, I want to play a little game with you right now. You know, you mentioned that you did an interview here with Mindy Kaling and Lang Fisher, and I've seen that show, and it's a very good show. But before we go into listening to your interview there, can you play this game with me? It's called Never Have I Ever Watched. And this is there something, you're the TV critic, you're the TV maven, is there something on there, you know, on television that will shock people that you have never seen in the past? I'll start. I have never seen any show with variations of the initial CSINCISN any way you want to talk about it.
Really?
Never. Not
never?
One. Never have I ever seen.
Wow.
One.
I have to say, this is a game where I am going to prove the loser here, because I can't really think of a never have I ever.
You've seen it all.
I was going to kind of give the same answer as well. Say, oh, NCIS is something like that. But it's not true. I actually have watched them. I've covered season finales and the leaving of major actors and character arcs and what have you. I will tell you what I definitely did not watch a lot of. And it's can I at least get away with that?
Okay. Yes.
All right. I am not the biggest Friends fan you're ever going to meet.
No.
And I am not the biggest fan of Two and a Half Men and then variations on those type of themes. I love broad comedy. I really do. But I find a lot of network comedy specifically from the 90s, which has become a glory period for a lot of people. Just is so cringe inducing, and it was kind of cringe then. It was just really uncool, and now it just feels so old, and that's just one I'm never going to get past. But there are a lot of those. I mean, I just named two off the top of my head, mainly because we were talking about there are a lot. The American version of The Office to me was like, I would watch the first 5 minutes because of what was ever on before it. And then I would just go, oh, I really wish I could watch the English one again. And luckily, in the Netflix world, I can. So, you know, I'm good there.
So we're right back where we started here, against Peacock, against HBO Max, with their big signature shows that do have, in all fairness, and I love Friends and The Office, and they have devoted cult followings. There are people.
Not my friend, not cult followings. They have legions following them. Yeah. Cult followings is like Better Things, you know, or FX right. Cable or a show like that. These are millions of people watch these shows. And you're right in many ways. These are the hooks that they are hoping to attract with. I just feel if you're coming into a world where Netflix reigns so strong, where Amazon are so strong, where the Disney-controlled Hulu, now with FX as a part of their online components, have so much firepower, I feel like you have to show up with your best game, and your best game has to be a shiny new thing, because that's what's going to make people know that you're the new kid in town. And unfortunately, Quibi, Peacock, and HBO Max, they don't have that yet. But maybe they're going to rewrite the rules. Now, this is my segue to rewriting the rules. We all know Mindy Kaling from The Mindy Project, from The Office, from many other things, from her Emma Thompson movie on Amazon Late Night. But this show that she created with Lang Fisher, Never Have I Ever, a young adult show for Netflix, is, you could almost say, universally critically acclaimed. I gave it a great review, and I am far from alone in the maddening crowd there. And I was so excited, and I say that with a bit of fanboyism, to talk to the two of them about the process of creating this show and all that went into this very, very unique take, very complex and nuanced take on growing up in America.
You know, one of the elements of Never Have I Ever, it deals a lot with loss. It deals a lot with pain. It deals with it in a very different way than most adolescent shows did. To both of you, please, why did you decide that was a main plot line that you wanted to build upon?
Well, both Mindy and I have lost a parent, and so we have experienced that sort of pain. But I think for us, what we wanted was a show that had depth, and that our main character had depth. And I think personally, like, teenagers usually have some real adult size pain going on in their lives most of the time, and are usually unable to process it. And I think we both thought that it would be good if our character, you know, had like sort of a deep wound that she was dealing with and struggling with, which we thought, you know, because one thing we really wanted was like a teenager who had like a big personality and had like some real problems and, you know, had a temper. And mm-hmm. and we felt like that needed to come from somewhere. It couldn't just come from her being a brat.
One thing that's different about streaming than, say, broadcast television is when it all comes down and all gets dropped in one season, the response is different. Week by week, people can play out things and watch stories happen. What has been the response that the two of you have had
The biggest response that I feel we see on Twitter or from anecdotally is that everyone watched the entire thing in 5 hours, which is such
a- I can admit to that.
And what's great about having everyone watch it in such a short period of time is you don't necessarily get the complaint early on of, well, how come we're not seeing the other characters? They're not developed. It's like, well, you have access to all of them. You can see them. And that is so great coming from, you know, Lang and I have so much network television experience. And again, on doing Netflix, you don't have to do a 21 and a half minute episode. And so the biggest complaint when you do a network show is, well, the other characters aren't really established as well. And it's like, yeah, because we only had this amount of time. Some of our episodes were 28 minutes long, and that let us see, you know, much more of Kamala, the girl who was living, the cousin who's living in the house, and all the other characters. So doing a show at Netflix creatively was just really amazing for us.
Of course, Never Have I Ever came out as many of us were beginning to go into the coronavirus lockdown throughout the United States and around the world. I feel in some ways, you know, this has been, people have been watching more television in the past several weeks than they've been watching in years. Do you feel that that allowed you in a way to have even more direct relationship with the multitudes of your audience? And do you feel that that was beneficial?
Yeah, the pandemic was bad for the world, but it was really good for our show. Like, it was like, you know, it was, I truly think that people gave the show a chance. I mean, there's so much about the show which you could construe as niche. You could say, oh, it's about women. Oh, it's about Indian people. It's high school. You know, I don't know if I'm into it. But what was so great was because everyone is trapped, they were sort of forced to become more open-minded about what they were going to watch. And so we feel like we really benefited from it. And the other thing, too, is people really wanted to watch funny stuff. The trailer for our show promised a sexy romp show, you know, something that felt like it was a really funny, raunchy teen show. And then the show delivered on something, I think, that dealt with a lot more issues than necessarily the trailer promised. And so we were really happy with how many people watched it. I mean, 5 days after, I think, Lang, wasn't it like almost a week after we saw that the show was like number one almost around the world?
I think it was a couple of days after, yeah.
And it continued to be for a long time afterwards. It wasn't just a peak.
Oh, well, so that I think was really due to the timing. So for a little show, like for us, the timing of this at a time when most people are at home and they want to watch something funny, like we really benefited from that. And we're so grateful. Not for the pandemic. We're not grateful for the pandemic, but we're grateful that we were able to.
It is headline tomorrow. Mindy happy about pandemic.
Yes, not the headline we're going to say.
And so with that, thanks for listening to this episode of the Deadline Podcast TV Talk. Now make sure you subscribe, if you don't already, to us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you never, ever miss an episode.
And of course, you can find all of our Emmy breaking news coverage, whether it be streamers, our broadcast networks, or whatever, right at deadline.com.
As well as all the breaking news on what's going down on the entertainment industry. And so with that, thanks for joining us this week, and goodbye.